Welcome, family. Welcome to EWTN Live. I know as you saw us panning across the audience there, you can see Father Frank Pavone. He had celebrated Mass earlier today. And I was welcoming you to the studio audience. Great to have you. Everybody's quite familiar with him. And we also have to welcome a brand new cable company that's taking us on. We're very pleased to welcome Time Warner Digital Cable in the Jackson, Mississippi metro area, and also in Monroe and West Monroe, Louisiana. Now, be sure to write and thank Mr. Martin Peterson. He's the vice president of Time Warner in Mississippi, and he helped make it possible to add on EWTN. So let him know that you appreciate that, and we're so glad to get in contact with all you folks in Jackson and Monroe. And, you know, this is January, and one of the great saints that we celebrate, the patron saint of theologians, among many other things that he did, and this is a feast of St. Thomas Aquinas coming up later this month. And so, what we have available is a small prayer card of St. Thomas Aquinas. It mentions that his feast day is on the 28th of January, and it has a prayer asking his intercession. And Lord knows, those of us who do theology and philosophy for a living need all the prayers we can get. So, if you'd like one of these little cards, as a matter of fact, maybe you know somebody who's not so smart, and you want to get them to pray for them. That's a good thing, because St. Thomas Aquinas was known by his classmates as the dumb ox. And for a dumb ox, he did pretty well. So they would seek out his prayers, have sought him out. It's a $2 little plastic-coated prayer card, and you can write to Mother Angelica, Irondale, Alabama, 35210. So let's write to Mother Angelica, Irondale, Alabama, 35210, and get praying for all the dumb oxes in your life. What if my mother had those? I don't know. She probably did. Tonight being Wednesday, and EWTN Live means that we have a guest, a live guest. And I'm very excited about this because this guest is going to talk to us about St. Thomas Aquinas. It's Dr. Teresa Farnan, who is a professor at Mount St. Mary's Seminary. A number of the fathers and brothers from the order here, the Franciscans, go to that seminary to study. They recommended her as a teacher. One of the things that they pointed out to me is that when she would have a new baby, she'd bring the child into class. So learning starts early in her family. So please welcome Dr. Teresa Farnan. Welcome.
Thank you, Father. Thank you.
Great to have you here.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
How many kids do you have?
I have six.
Six. And so you can do Thomas and babies.
I have taught Thomas holding a baby in my arms.
I've heard from the guys. They told me all about it. That's great. So do the kids learn Latin or English first?
English first, but they're working on their Latin.
Good.
My 3-year-old can say Hail Mary in Latin.
Is that right? All right. Now, you got that. A 3-year-old saying a Hail Mary in Latin.
Yes.
All right, well, we should get them saying in English. Not your child, but I mean kids in general. So, yeah, you can do it. You can get them to pray. That's wonderful.
People underestimate children. They really
do. I know. As a matter of fact, being the proud mom that you are, you just happen to have a photograph of your children, don't you?
Yes, I do.
Yeah, I know. You said they'd kill you if you don't bring it. So let's take a look at the photo that you have of all your kids.
Okay.
There they are. There they are, all six. And what's the oldest one?
The oldest one is Michael.
Uh-huh. And how old?
He's 9 years old.
And then down to?
Mary Rose is 8 years old. And Jean is 6 years old.
Uh-huh.
And Joseph is 4 and a half. Elizabeth Ann is 3. And Sarah is 1 and a half.
Great. Oh, God bless you. Nice looking kids. I'm sure they're happy to see Anya. Though I understand they wanted to be here, too.
They wanted to be here. They said this was their only chance to be on television. They didn't believe me when I said, no, someday you'll be on
TV. You can do it on your own. You can start singing Rosie in Latin on TV. And
that's right.
Be amazed.
That's right. There we go.
Well, great to have you here to talk about St. Thomas, because St. Thomas certainly has set a major tone for Catholic theology since the 13th century. And it's rich. You know, Thomas certainly has this breadth of vision that has influenced people since, including the present Pope is very strongly influenced by St. Thomas. Given all that he's written, what do you want to talk about?
What I usually do with the seminarians, because we're forming at the Mount where all of the academics are with an eye towards the formation of priests for their ministry.
Right.
So what I try to do in my course is I try to bring in as many contemporary issues as I can and help them to understand that when you study St. Thomas, it's not just for the sake of knowing a historical figure. Mm-hmm. It's really so that you can learn more about the truth. Yeah. And the truth about things today. So there's a lot that St. Thomas has to offer us even today. Mm-hmm. And there are a number of issues that I often bring up with my students.
For example?
Well, one of the issues that is really dear to my heart, and I think it's dear to the Holy Father's heart because he devoted a whole encyclical to the splendor of truth, mm-hmm. is the whole issue of truth. Yeah. Now, we're in a culture today that has relativized truth. And when I say relativized, I mean they have attempted to redefine truth or even deny that there is such a thing as truth.
Mm-hmm.
And so what you'll
as a matter of fact, don't we have people who say, well, you know, that's your truth.
Yes.
But I have my truth.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, you know, so which means that you can't communicate between truths, and maybe it's not true.
That's exactly right. And let me give you a really, really good example of this. I have 6 kids. Mm-hmm. I've gone into various doctors, and now I'm privileged to have some pro-life obstetricians. But before, when I was going to obstetricians who weren't so pro-life, one of the things that always struck me was that when you would go into the doctor's office and you were pregnant, they would refer to your unborn child as the fetus until they discovered that you intended to carry the baby to term. Then, suddenly, when they realized that you embraced being the mother of that child, then they would refer to that baby as a baby.
Wow.
So there was an attempt made to sort of to deny the truth of that person by using a term that really doesn't evoke the same emotional reaction and that allows you to deny your relationship to that child and deny the personhood of that child.
So they create the truth the same. Their truth is that's the fetus.
Yes, yes.
As opposed to until you come up with your truth, that's my child. I'm the mom.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, okay.
And what always struck me about that is that the truth in that situation for those doctors depends on your emotional reaction and isn't related at all to the reality of that child.
Okay.
Now, that always, always amazed me. And we see it in other areas. We see it also in issues like euthanasia, where it will be referred to as mercy killing. Now, mercy and killing don't go together. Those are two words that don't go together. And yet, when you put them together like that, it enables people to deny what's really happening in that action.
So that my truth is I'm being merciful because I think you're tired of living.
Yes.
So I'll show you mercy. I'll kill you.
Right, yeah. Right.
Well, yeah.
Well, that's really what they're saying.
Yeah.
It doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
It doesn't make sense at all. But that's where our culture is. We've made truth dependent on feelings and on emotions and on whatever you decide you want the truth to be.
Mm-hmm.
And so I always bring up these examples with the seminarians at Mount St. Mary's because I think that it's important to realize just where our culture is. And then I start to talk about what St. Thomas can offer us.
Mm-hmm.
And what St. Thomas says about truth is really beautiful. He defines, first of all, he talks about God as truth. God is unchanging. God is truth. So truth is unchanging. So immediately we have a fixed standard for truth.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
And which is, again, something that is not very well accepted. If truth is based on how I feel about something, then it changes with my feelings.
Well, exactly.
But if truth is based on God and it's unchanging, then I have to adapt to the truth rather than make the truth adapt to me.
Exactly. And that's what people in our culture are unwilling to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's important to have, really, to have an adequate understanding of what truth is.
Mm-hmm.
St. Thomas goes on and he talks about how what truth really is when your understanding of something actually matches or corresponds to the way that thing really is. Now, that sounds like common sense. It sounds like obvious. Mm-hmm. I mean, a child could define truth as in that way. But we've lost that.
How do you think we've lost that?
Well, there are a lot of things. I think a lot of factors at play here. I mean, for one thing, people really, really want to perform certain actions. And when we redefine words and start to shift what truth means, it gives you an opportunity to do what you want to do. Do something that's easy rather than face up to some of the challenges that life is presenting you with. But there are a lot of other factors really that are at play here. But this is one of the things I talk to my seminarians a lot about, because I think it's really important, and I think it's important to recover the fact that truth is unchanging. There's an unchanging reference point for truth, and that if the idea that we have in our mind does not adequately represent the reality of whatever it is we're talking about, then we're mistaken. And we're not acting in truth. And when you don't act in truth, then things go horribly, horribly awry.
Well, see, that's one of the things that we certainly see, not on this talk show, but on a lot of talk shows, that, well, you know, if I start talking about the truth, won't I become judgmental about other people?
Well, that's true, but do you know what St. Thomas would respond to that?
No, I don't. What would he say? I have an idea.
St. Thomas would say that you have an obligation in charity to correct your brothers. And so if somebody is acting outside of the truth, you do have an obligation to speak the truth always.
So it's an act of charity to be judgmental.
It's an act of charity to present the truth.
Okay, all right, good. Good distinction. Well, that's marvelous. Now, one of the things that I think is part of the issue, too, is that if truth is based on emotion and therefore changes with emotion for the relativist people, how does a person understand the truth if the truth comes from God, as Christians believe and Thomas talks, how do you get to know that truth?
Well, there are a lot of different ways. If you're talking about truth about the world around you, obviously from the moment that we're born and we open our eyes and you see your mother, you begin to encounter other things. And your senses tell you a lot about the world around you. We can trust our senses. Our senses will inform you truly about the world around you. But there's more than that. God has put in our hearts, in our intellects, sort of a mental checks and balances facility where we can, if somebody says something, for example, if I were to say to you that coffee cup is a coffee cup and it's not a coffee cup, you would say, you're talking nonsense. That doesn't make sense. Yeah. We have this ability to distinguish when something is erroneous or when it's false intellectually. And God also has given us certain moral norms where we instinctively seek to do what's good. Mm-hmm. And so as soon as we identify something as good, we understand the truth about that object and we know that it's something that we should pursue.
Yeah.
And so God has given us, He creates us so that we're oriented towards the good, ordered towards Himself, oriented towards Himself. He is the good. And He provides us with the interior means of distinguishing the way to go there. He gives us the ability intellectually to distinguish truth from falsehood. Mm-hmm. And He gives us the ability intellectually to distinguish moral right and moral wrong.
So that and behind all that, you know, the gift that you mentioned of intellect, the ability to think,
yes,
to use reason,
yes,
and appropriate kinds of reason in appropriate situations. Mm-hmm. These are some of the gifts that we have.
Right.
And that's all wonderful, but we still disagree about, you know, we have people who disagree about things, and we have people who, you say, and Thomas says, we're ordered towards the good. Why are so many people taking on bad things?
One of the things is that I think people... Let's draw a couple of distinctions, okay? One of the problems that we have in our society is that people will do bad things and still believe that they're a good person. they don't understand that performing bad actions can make you a worse person. And that's something that St. Thomas talks about. I mean, that's his whole account of how we develop virtues or how we can develop vices, is based on that understanding that the actions that we perform make us a certain kind of person. And in our society, there's an attempt to separate this, to deny this, because people want to, I think really it comes down to a matter of people wanting to do what they want to do. Mm-hmm. We have a mistaken understanding of human freedom. They want to act in a certain way. And so when somebody comes along and says, you can do that and still be a good person, they're very eager to believe it.
One of the things I come across frequently is people will say to me, you know, I don't really need to go to confession. I'm a good person. I haven't killed anybody. And I said, well, yeah, you're a good person so long as you're comparing yourself to the mafia.
Right.
But, you know, there are other norms than the mafia by which you know, discern who whether you're good or not.
Well, that's exactly right.
And go ahead.
And here's another example, okay? We saw with all of those corporate scandals this past year, people were shocked and horrified by that. Executives cooking the books and doing all kinds of shady business practices, and people were really properly outraged. But here's the flip side. There are a lot of people out there who either don't report everything on their tax return, or how about this scenario? You're in the grocery store and the clerk gives you too much change. What do you do? How many people actually walk back in and give the clerk the money back?
Yeah.
How many people do that? Not that many. And what St. Thomas would say is that in performing those little actions where you sort of slide a little bit morally and you say, I'll just keep it. It's no big deal.
Yeah.
Exactly. When you take that attitude, what happens is that you dispose yourself to do more and more evil things. So that maybe today you're not bringing back the money on your that the cashier overpaid you. Maybe tomorrow you're withholding some information from the IRS, and in 20 years you're cooking your corporate books. It can be a slippery slope downhill.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that everybody, you know, continues to slide, but that's how you start to become, that's how people become evil. It's not, you know, people don't just wake up one day and murder someone. They've performed actions that have predisposed them to act in a certain way. They've developed bad habits, vices. And so as you develop these vices, suddenly one day it's very easy for you to pull that trigger, or it's very easy for you to steal that money.
Yeah. So that the, you know, that applies to so many areas that people might say, well, you know, I'm just looking at some pornography on the internet, but I'm not hurting anybody. That's just on the internet,
right?
Or in a magazine. But then, and studies show that desensitizes, you know, usually men, sometimes women, but usually men, to show disrespect. But, you know, they showed greater disrespect, and there's a connection between pornography and rape.
Right.
You know?
Absolutely.
And it's the same kind of beginning small and getting to a larger extent because you desensitize, you form a habit.
Right. But even more startling, one of the points St. Thomas makes in the Summa Theologiae is that one act of vice can cause you to lose a virtue. So one act of infidelity makes you an unfaithful husband.
All right. So that, say, once a husband is unfaithful to his wife, that is what constitutes him as an unfaithful husband.
One act.
Yeah.
One action. Mm-hmm. Looking at that pornography on the internet one time will cause you to lose the virtue of fidelity.
Yeah.
People don't realize that. People don't want to realize that.
Yeah. Wouldn't that be in some ways part of his understanding than a mortal sin? Why? Because sometimes you hear people say that, well, I remember a man saying this to me, he's a theologian, in fact. He was about 40 years old and said, well, now I'm finally psychologically mature enough that I am capable of committing a mortal sin. You know? And the idea that he had was, you have to have, you know, the super insightful perspective on yourself in order to know that you're doing something and be free enough, to commit the sin. So that, whereas Thomas wouldn't say that you have to have years of therapy before you're able to commit a mortal sin.
Well, let me tell you what St. Thomas says about sin. I have a first quote here where St. Thomas describes a sin. He says, every voluntary act that turns aside from the order of reason and of the eternal law is evil, and every good act is in accord with reason and the eternal law. So a sin for St. Thomas Aquinas is not is anything that is outside of God's law. And when he says in accord with reason, he means reason that is also in accord with the eternal law. Mm-hmm. In other words, your reason should be directed towards the true good, mm-hmm. who is God. Yeah. And so your reason should be telling you to do things that are in line with what God tells us, mm-hmm. to do. Mm-hmm. So for St. Thomas, any sin, a sin is something that is not in accord with reason, and that is at odds with what eternal law tells us.
And the assumption behind that, then, is that God's law is itself reasonable.
Yes.
So that it's not that God is saying, let me see, I'll see how I can test these folks. I'll say, you have to jump into fire and bring yourself up.
Right.
God doesn't give us laws like that.
No.
He gives us laws that protect us. And that are reasonable and good laws.
He is supremely reasonable. He is goodness. He wants us to come to him. And so when he gives us laws, they're a guide. They're intended to direct us to him. They're for our own good. Mm-hmm. We have such an immature understanding of what law is in our society today, in modern culture. We see law as something repressive, as something that is denying our freedom. But really, law is something that is guiding us towards the good.
It strikes me that the kind of perspective of law you just described is the same perspective that your 18-month-old child might have.
Yeah.
You know, mommy, I want it.
Right.
You know, and sometimes we have the same mentality instead of that. I'm sure the older children who know that you're so wise and that all your rules are absolutely sensible, right?
Absolutely. They're all angelic, yeah, even the 18-month-old. But no, that's absolutely right. It is in many ways it's an immature understanding, yeah. of what law is, and I really do believe that a lot of it is because we want to do certain things and we don't want any limitation on our freedom. We don't want a perceived limitation on our freedom. Yeah. We don't understand that true freedom is always directed towards the good, mm-hmm. and directed towards God. Mm-hmm. And so our whole culture has just lost this understanding of freedom, lost this understanding of law and of law as a guide towards God. And these are some of the things that St. Thomas really has to offer us.
Now, given that, we've been talking about a set of problems that we have. Sometimes a nearly infantile sense of freedom. I can do whatever I want because I'm willful. It's not freedom. It's, you know, insistence on my own willfulness rather than freedom. What do we do to correct this situation? We can see, we've talked about how you commit sins, you build habits of sin, and you go away from the good and you just focus on yourself. That's the problem. What do we do to correct it?
Well, there are so many different levels that we need to correct, that we need to pursue to correct this problem. On a personal level, mm-hmm. you have to orient your will towards God's. Mm-hmm. And you have to really, really embrace intellectually and emotionally with your will. You have to embrace this understanding that God is good, that he's a loving father, that he's guiding you towards the good. And so if he has something in store for you that might not be what you want, it's for your good. And so on a personal level, we need to do that. But also in our society, I think we really need to recover this understanding of truth. We need to recover this understanding of God as the good towards whom we are all directed. And we really need to talk about the correct understanding of freedom. And thank heaven we have our Holy Father today, because he's done so much to articulate these notions and get these ideas out where they should be in public discourse. Mm-hmm. His encyclical on the splendor of truth was absolutely magnificent. Yeah. And it relied a lot on St. Thomas as a foundation for his discussion of the fundamental moral norms, the natural law is what St. Thomas would call it. But he really has done a lot to articulate the fact that we need to recover the proper understanding of truth and the proper understanding of freedom and our relation to God.
And even the title that he gives, the splendor of truth, that truth is not just this cold, hard piece of steel to which you conform, but there's a splendor, there's a radiance that comes from truth, as he describes it.
Yes.
And that it's something that's attractive.
Yes.
And that's part of also we have to recover for our folks. It's not the cold thing that stops my willfulness. It's something that should attract me.
That's exactly right. And you know what? This puts a little bit of a I don't want to say burden, but it does impose on those of us who know the truth. We must always present the truth as something attractive. Mm-hmm. We have to be really, really careful, I think, not to present the truth as something repressive. When we talk about moral laws, we shouldn't present them just as negatives. Yeah. They're positive.
Yeah.
They're for our good. They guide us towards God. They're good things. This is what we should be doing is we should be saying, this is how to be happy. You follow these guidelines, you'll be really happy. Because you know what? St. Thomas would say, everyone wants happiness. And that's what we need to do. And we need to do it with a smile on our faces.
You know, I think back with little kids that are in charge. When you put the older kids in charge of the younger ones, oftentimes they're stricter than parents are. Right?
Yes.
And one of the things that the best they can do in terms of moral summons is to say, you better, I'll tell.
Right.
Or,
right.
You know, mom, you'll get you. And it's that kind of attitude that you don't only see with kids, but sometimes among us Christians who are mature, sort of. that sometimes we can say, you better do this or you're going to burn in hell.
Right.
You know, we can be as just like the older kids in the family,
right,
who are trying to keep control of the younger ones because we know we're not really in charge.
Right, right. No, that's exactly right. And you know what? Do you know what St. Thomas speaks to this very thing? Because one of the things that he says, he has a magnificent section on fear, where he talks about what should fear of the Lord be. And he talks about different kinds of fear. You can mm-hmm. have the fear of somebody who's a servant, servile fear. You can have someone who's acting out of fear of punishment. Mm-hmm. But is that how we're supposed to be acting? No. We're supposed to be acting from filial fear, which is the fear of a son or a daughter towards mm-hmm. God. And really what that means is that we don't want to disappoint God. We don't want to do something that would be at odds with what he wants for us. We know that he loves us and we want to follow his will. And so our fear is that we won't follow his will 100%.
Yeah.
And that's very different from this repressive understanding of fear and you know, acting this way so you don't burn in hell. It's a much more positive understanding.
Yeah. Well, thanks. That's a great start for our conversation. We're going to take a break now, but it's not over. When we come back, we're going to take your questions and questions from our audience here and, you know, pepper Dr. Farnan with all kinds of good stuff to know more about this great insight into Thomas. So please stay with us. Thank you. Welcome back. We're back with Dr. Teresa Farnan, who teaches Thomistic philosophy or theology, or
philosophy.
Both? Philosophy.
Philosophy.
Over at Mount St. Mary's. How long have you been teaching there?
For 3 years.
Uh-huh. All right. Good.
Three and a half years.
Don't you like teaching?
I absolutely love it. And I'll tell you what, I could not imagine a better place to teach than Mount St. Mary's.
It's
really wonderful. The faculty is so supportive. Our rector has been wonderful as far as accommodating different. I've had two babies since I was there. And I've taught class with the babies, so that tells you how flexible they are.
Most seminary rectors aren't accustomed to that problem with the faculty.
This is new, but he rolled with it.
That's good. Well, we're going to start off with a questioning from here in the studio. Where are you from?
I'm from a. Right now, we're coming from Norcross, Georgia.
Uh-huh.
But originally, I was born in Ghana.
In Ghana.
But I lived most of my life in Nigeria.
Okay.
Yeah, it was way back in 1981. It was about 5 o'clock dawn time. And when I heard a knock on my door, I opened the door and I saw some uniformed men.
Yeah.
And they asked me whether there were some illegal immigrants then in Nigeria.
Uh-huh.
Because there was a government order to get at all illegal immigrants,
yeah.
And I lied that they weren't. But there were some illegal immigrants in my house.
I see.
I knew that they would have been subjected to so much torture,
uh-huh.
Probably even God knows what would have happened to them. So in that instance, in order to save their lives, I lied.
So you told a lie to save some people from being tortured by the soldiers who came to your door.
Exactly.
Now, how does that relate to dealing with the truth? St. Thomas says.
Oh, well, that's always a difficult moral issue. I had a seminarian actually who wrote a paper on that very issue, because when you have an example like that, that is horrendous.
Mm-hmm.
Well, here is, I think, what St. Thomas would say. He would never condone lying, but he would also say that you don't have someone in a situation like that, as soldiers who are attempting to do something evil, you don't have a responsibility to tell them the truth. So your best answer in that situation would be to be as evasive as possible or not say anything. He never says it's morally all right to tell a lie, because for St. Thomas, you always want to be ordered towards the truth. But on the other hand, you those people did not have any kind of duty, or you don't have a responsibility to disclose that information to them.
Right. Matter of fact, you might have a duty not to disclose it, because you'd be affecting people's lives. And there are ways to get around this, that, all sorts of moral qualifications. I remember Raymond Arroyo was telling me a story of some nuns that he met who were hiding Jews in their convent. Pius XII had told them to hide Jews, and they were scared.
Mm-hmm.
But They hid the Jews underneath the stage in the auditorium of the school that they had. And there are 30 Jewish people hiding there. So the nuns got on the stage and started acting as if they were practicing a tap dance routine to drown out any noise. They say, Jews in a convent? What would Jews be doing in a convent? Now, they didn't say there were no Jews there.
Right.
They just expressed surprise. What would Jews do in a convent?
Right.
They didn't say one thing one way or the other.
Well, here's a story that always stuck in my mind. I read the book The Hiding Place when I was when I was young, and there's a passage in there where she describes how they'd hidden some Jews in a trap door underneath their kitchen
Right, and this
floor.
Is, by the way, just so people know, The Hiding Place is a book by Corey Ten Boom about a family that hid Jews and then got arrested themselves and put in a concentration camp.
Exactly. So the Jews were hidden underneath the kitchen floor, and then they pulled the table back over and put the tablecloth on. Well, the Nazis burst into the room, and they said, "Where are the Jews?" Now, Corrie ten Boom had a sister who was truthful, and she was petrified because she said, "I know she's going to tell the truth, and then we'll all be discovered." Well, her sister said, "They're under the table." And the Nazis pulled up the tablecloth, and there was no one there, and they left. So there's an example of how she told the truth.
Yeah.
She didn't lie. God protected her.
Yeah. So and there are times in which you have to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there are times in a lot of other circumstances. I'm sure there are times that your children ask you questions that they're not capable of understanding yet.
That's exactly right. But you don't lie to them.
That's right.
You don't lie to them. You might not present the fullness of truth.
Right.
So we take evasive maneuvers sometimes.
Sure. And that's something that's a very important process because, again, in the case of a child who's not capable of understanding all the truth, you don't give them more than they can handle, but you don't lie to them either.
And that's exactly right.
That's what we have. This is where also being clever and using our reason comes in. We have a call already. Hello?
Hello.
Hello, where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Missouri.
Missouri. And what's your question, please?
Father, my question is this. I believe that St. Thomas, as well as St. Augustine, had talked about the concept of a just war. And I just wonder how your guests would think that he would view the pending war with Iraq and the whole idea of a preemptive strike and the serious questions about whether, you know, it's serious enough a threat for us to go to war.
Okay. First of all, define, thank you for that call, by the way. Define what Thomas and Augustine might mean by a just war.
Well, a just war would be a war that is, first of all, obviously carried out for a just reason. For example, self-defense.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it would have to be proportional. It wouldn't be correct to if your neighbor borrows your and this is a trivial example, but if your neighbor borrows your snowblower without asking, it isn't right to go over there and inflict serious harm.
Towards his house or something.
Right. So the response has to be proportional, and this goes along with St. Thomas's principle of double effect, where you, in intending to defend yourself, you're not intending to go out and murder innocent people. What you're intending to do is to defend yourself. Or in some cases, defend others who are entrusted to you. A father who has someone break into the house is morally obligated to defend his children who are entrusted to him. And so as far as the war, the current situation, I'm a little hesitant to answer that because I don't feel like I have all the information. And that's unfortunately is one of the problems. I know our bishops have spoken on the issue. And their concern, I think, would rightly be that you don't want to enter into something where innocent people are harmed. Yeah. And that's always a concern with war. But again,
And that's a big part of the just war theory, too, mm-hmm. that you may not go after non-combatants.
Right.
And again, I would agree. I don't know nearly enough of the information. A lot of it is secret information, and that's difficult in a democracy.
Exactly.
We have to know as much information as is legitimate to know to make these decisions. But we do have to take a look and see, is this something that warrants an attack? Is it for defense?
Right.
Are we trying? If we were trying to conquer Iraq and take it over, that would be immoral by Thomas' standards,
if
right?
If we were trying to take Iraq for its oil,
yeah.
That would be immoral.
Yeah.
That absolutely. If we were trying to invade them and take it over so we would have more land,
yeah.
That would be immoral.
Right. So. And one of the things, just as a little side point that I'm aware of from watching the Lebanese television stations, that the relics of St. Thérèse of Lisieux were brought to Lebanon. They were there for about 7 weeks. Then they took them over to Iraq, and they're there right now. And I really urge all of us to pray that a peaceful resolution, because the last thing I would ever want to see is a single, citizen killed. I don't want to see anybody killed.
Absolutely.
And I think to really ask St. Thérèse of Lisieux to pray and intercede for the people of Iraq, both so that any problems they have with their own government and such would be there, and also that it would be resolved, and that we too would, not have to go to war.
Right. Here's one more thing on that question.
Sure.
There's a lot of talk in the past couple of years about whether or not we should have assassinated Saddam Hussein,
mm-hmm.
And St. Thomas speaks very definitely on that issue, and his point is you should never. Never undertake what he calls tyrannicide, which means you assassinate mm-hmm. A dictator,
mm-hmm.
and he is definitely opposed to it. And so when people in our country start talking about that as a viable option, it really is a horrendous thing.
Because it goes back to what you said before. That would fit into our truth. Well, it would be convenient to be rid of him.
Yes, exactly.
You know, and that would not be correct. All right, I have another call already. Hello?
Hello.
Hello, where are you calling from?
Louisiana.
Louisiana, what's your question?
A little bit earlier, Dr. Fornan said, I believe that St. Thomas said, if one bad act can take away virtue, can the virtue be restored by going to confession?
There you go. So if one bad act, if one act of infidelity makes you an unfaithful person, then can that virtue be restored by going to confession?
Well, that's a very good question. And obviously, I mean, confession is something that heals the person, but you also need to perform actions. And this is why we have penances when we go to confession, because it's important not just that obviously confession is the first thing you should do, but then you need to start bringing that virtue back into your life and practicing that virtue and building it up again. So if you're someone who's committed an act of infidelity, go to confession, but then you also need to begin consciously practicing acts of fidelity towards your husband or your wife.
Yeah.
And make certain that you are doing everything you can to acquire that virtue. And then, of course, pray, because God, in his grace and mercy, does all things.
I was at a marrying conference this past weekend giving a talk about confession. And one of the elements, you know, because people say, well, aren't you saved just if you have faith? Well, faith is a start. But as you say, you have to undo some of the effects. And the way I like to think of it is, when we sin, we've gone off the path that God has before us. We've gone off the path of truth. It's not enough. When you've taken the wrong turn, I'm like most guys. I'm willing to drive without asking directions. All right? We mean stopping the gas station for directions. Listen, we'll find it. And so, at a certain point, when you realize you're on the wrong road, you have to then stop and say, oh, I'm on the wrong road, and then keep going? No, that's wrong.
That's
stupid. You have to get back, trace your steps back, undo what you've done, and then get on the right road and start going what's right. That's what confession is for. You stop and realize this is wrong.
Right.
And then you come back and then get going on the right path. And that's why we have to take these actions. So it doesn't just confessing the sin doesn't restore the virtue, but it gets it to stop, and then you have to start taking the actions.
Exactly.
All right. So so that's a very key point. Now, somebody had a question that they don't have them on the line right now, but they did say something about, what about the commandment, thou shalt not kill? You know, how can you say that there's any such thing as a just war when the Bible says thou shalt not kill?
Oh, that's a very good question. St. Thomas says that the only time any kind of act of homicide, I suppose, killing, would be justifiable is if you're acting in self-defense. Now, here's where the principle of double effect comes in, because the intention is not to kill the person. The intention is to drive back whatever thing is threatening you, okay? And it always has to be proportional. So, for example, if a 12-year-old boy breaks into your house and is unarmed but sort of threatens to punch you, are you really justified in shooting him?
No,
not if you
not.
Can subdue him physically.
Right.
On the other hand, if somebody is going to shoot you, that may be what you may have to kill
stop
that person
yeah.
to stop them.
Yeah.
And so what St. Thomas says, I think, is eminently reasonable, because what he's saying is your life is a good thing. We have an instinctive desire to protect our own life.
And there's also just a little extra word. There are three words for killing in Hebrew. And two of them mean either kill in battle, execute criminals, kill in a fight. It has a wide range of meanings. But in the commandment, the Hebrew word simply means to murder.
Mm.
So it's a specific word, that, usually by stealth.
Right.
So that's what's forbidden. We have another call already. Hello?
Hello.
Hi, where are you from?
This is Jack Harrington. I'm calling from Mount St. Mary Seminary.
Wait a minute.
Oh, I'm playing.
Well, there's a bunch of them. So the old ones are
really
playing,
Hello, Dr. Farnsworth.
Hello.
I'm a third. Dr. Farnan. Excuse me. Dr. Farnan, I'm a third-year theologian. I haven't had you as an instructor, but we've been all talking about how Thomas explains how grace builds on nature, and we were wondering if you could explain the theological virtues, how the theological virtues are virtues that are not arrived at naturally but supernaturally.
Okay, that's an excellent question. Of course, from a seminarian from the Mount.
And grades aren't even due yet. They're already
trying to get. He's not even one of my students. Imagine the questions my students had. Here's what St. Thomas says about his whole understanding of the distinctions between and the relationship between grace and nature. God created us with a certain nature. He created us in a certain way, but he intends us for an end that's beyond us, an end that is supernatural. Supernatural means it's above our nature, and so we can't achieve it by our own efforts. And so God, in his infinite mercy and goodness, has given us, he infuses the theological virtues in us, the virtues of faith, hope, and charity. And it's through those virtues that we can come to know God better. And really, they help us to reach this supernatural end. And so St. Thomas is constantly saying grace perfects nature, grace builds on nature. And what it means is that God doesn't want to do away with everything he created us with. He created us good, and our nature is good because it's one of his creations. And so what he does is he restores it through the theological virtues, and he perfects it so that we can someday see him in the beatific vision.
You know, and I think that's important to bring out, that grace builds on nature, because sometimes due to the sins that people commit, there are people who are tempted to despair about nature, about the human nature. And they're tempted to say that human nature is all bad.
That's right.
And that's a false option.
Right.
Creation is good. And even, you know, for people who eat too much, hunger is still good, and your stomach is good, and taste of food is good. It's just a matter of letting God's grace help you to have control over that or any other appetite.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And the other point is that there are people who attempt to excuse everything that they do that's wrong because of their nature.
Right.
And that's wrong too.
Yep.
Because God gives us the grace to overcome these things. And so
right.
you
right.
ask him. And
yeah, just to say, well, that's just human nature to do these bad things.
Right.
No.
Right. No, that's correct.
We have another call already. Hello?
Hello.
Hi. Where are you from?
Wichita.
Wichita. And what's your question?
My question is to Dr. Farman. I read in the book of St. Thomas Aquinas that just at his deathbed, with all the brilliant work he has done in theology, he said that it was all straw. Can you explain that?
Oh.
All right, so the statement is that as Thomas was dying, he said that it's all straw. And he died as a fairly young man.
He was 49.
Very young, just a kid. Now that I'm 53. So what does that statement mean?
Well, what happened was that at the end of St. Thomas's life, he had some kind of mystical experience while he was celebrating Mass. And what's generally believed is that it was some kind of a vision of God, a vision of things to come. And it left him absolutely shaken and unable to write. And people said to him, it was unusual because he was keeping up an unbelievable pace. He was sleeping like 4 hours a day, getting up and writing in the middle of the night, you know, writing nonstop. And so people came up to him and they said, "Why aren't you writing, Thomas? Why aren't you writing?" And what he answered to them was, he said, "All that I have written seems like straw compared to what he had seen." Mm-hmm. Now that to me is actually, in one sense, your first reaction is, oh, if what he's written is straw, forget it, what can the rest of us do? But on the other hand, it's really a very beautiful story, because everything that he's written is so beautiful, so filled with the truth. And if he thinks that's just straw compared to what's waiting for us, wow.
Yeah, so he's not saying that, oh, I was all wrong.
No.
He's just saying that compared to this vision that he had of God or of heaven or something, this wonderful stuff is like straw.
That's right.
And, you know, this is something that I certainly wanted to bring up. This man mentioned that he was reading some Thomas. Where does a person start off to read Thomas? Or how do you get started in that? Because it's not always so easy.
It isn't easy. You're right.
Where do you start?
Well, if you're someone who is privileged enough to be able to take a class, that certainly is what I would recommend. Yeah. But you can educate yourself mm-hmm. in the philosophy and theology of St. Thomas Aquinas. And what I would recommend is that you get either a copy of The Summa of the Summa by Peter Kreeft. It's available from Ignatius mm-hmm. Press. Or A Tour of the Summa by Monsignor Glenn, and that's available from Tan Books. And both of those are very good because they abridge the Summa. Now, I use the Summa of the Summa in my class, and the reason why I do that is because the footnotes are immensely helpful.
How about something like Father Frederick Copleston as an introduction?
That's excellent. Works by Peter Kreeft are also excellent. Works by Ralph McInerney, he's written some. I believe his Handbook for Peeping Thomas is one that's intended specifically for people who are beginners. But, you know, I would really encourage people, if you really want to start knowing more about St. Thomas and you've never had any philosophy before, I think probably the easiest way to begin is to pull out G.K. Chesterton's book, The Dumb Ox. Because it's not technical, but it really captures the spirit of St. Thomas Aquinas.
Yeah.
And it's a good background work. And so when you start to pick up these other works, you'll be informed, and you'll understand a little bit more about St. Thomas, and I think it will be easier.
Yeah, I find that is a great little start mm-hmm. to understanding Thomas.
Right.
And some of these other texts, like Kreeft and others, I think really help out. It's not easy to start someone as clever as Thomas to begin reading there, but you can do it. Others have, and you can get started. And, you know, sometimes people can get started on, you know, with a small group of people.
Exactly.
But they can't find a professor.
Exactly.
That's why one of the things you can do is take a look at our religious catalog or our website at www.ewtn.com. And check out some of the stuff that we might have there in terms of the books available on St. Thomas. I don't know if we have The Dumb Ox or not, but, you know, you can check. That's available, too. I think Ignatius Press has reprinted
yes.
it, and many others have as well. So, and Peter Kreeft's book is also available in print. These are around. And there's so many nonsensical things to read. I recommend using this.
Right.
You know, that this is something that, you know, much, much better to read than a lot of junk.
Well, here's the other thing about St. Thomas. It can be difficult to wade through some of the objections and the said contras and everything else. But really, a lot of the ideas, if you're someone who knows your catechism, the ideas are ideas you're familiar with.
Yeah.
Because he's influenced so much of the teaching of our faith, how we understand and explain things.
And the great thing, too, about Thomas is that you see him set up a question. That's how it organizes it.
Mm-hmm.
And then he says all the objections to the Catholic position.
Mm-hmm.
And then he gives answers to each objection, and it comes up with how the truth works. And it's just really is an amazing way to learn how to think. That's why when I was doing some work in helping people get out of cults and things, one of the things that cult experts, Catholic and non-Catholic alike, said, if you want to get out of cult thinking, read Thomas Aquinas. He'll help you learn how to think and love reasonably the truth.
Amazing.
I'm just delighted to have you here. I hope that you come back.
Thank you.
If you have to bring a kid with you, they hold you hostage otherwise.
Well, my husband's the hero. He's the one at home with six kids right now.
God bless him. So we definitely would like to have you come back. And if he has to come too, he can come too. We'll figure it out. But please do.
That'd
be wonderful. And I hope all of you... you know, take up from some of this and use some of the great gift of Thomas and of Dr. Farnan's own wisdom and teaching to help us in becoming more wise ourselves. I'd like to conclude by giving a blessing. May the Lord bless you and keep you and cause His face to shine upon you. I bless you in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen.
Amen.
And I always want to remind you that this network is brought to you by you. If you don't help us out, then we can't be here. We can't present great stuff like Dr. Teresa Farnan has brought here tonight. So please, remember us in between your gas bill and electric bill. And I know the economy sometimes is hard for us, but we have to pay the same bills you do too. So keep us in mind and keep this network going so we can bring the splendor of truth to everybody around the world. Thank you.